Johnson said he didn't understand. Why not take it on the first trip? The chances we get raided on our first leg are probably better than the chances the second load will get discovered here, he said. Plus, we should be able to pick up some extra hands at Cow Island to protect us on the second trip. Their initial journey was uneventful. They reached Cow Island in the early evening and dined with the army troops stationed there. Marsh and his men had gone down the Missouri on the previous steamer, after warning the troops of copes, cutthroats, and vagabonds, who might appear later. Captain Lawson laughed. I think Mr. Marsh bears no love for your party, he said. Cope affirmed that was the case. The steamboat was due in 2 days, but the schedule was uncertain, especially so late in the year. It was imperative that they make their final trip to the Plains camp the following day. Cope would remain in Cow Island, repacking the fossils for the steamboat journey, while Little Wind and Cookie drove the wagon back in the morning under Sternberg's supervision. But early the next morning, Sternberg awoke with severe chills and fever, a recurrence of his malaria. Isaac was too jumpy about Indians to go back. Cookie and Little Wind too unreliable to go unsupervised. There was the question as to who would lead the expedition. Johnson said, I'll lead it. It was the moment he had been waiting for. Summer on the plains had toughened him, but he had always been under the supervision of older and more experienced men. He longed for a chance to prove himself on his own, and this short trip seemed the perfect opportunity for independence, and a fitting conclusion to the summer's adventures. Toad felt the same way. He immediately said, I'll go too. You two shouldn't make the trip alone, Cope said. I haven't been able to find any extra hands. The soldiers are unavailable to us. We won't be alone. We'll have Cookie and Little Wind. Cope frowned. He drummed his fingers nervously on his sketchbook. Please, Professor. It's important that you repack the fossils. We will be fine. And the day is passing as we stand here discussing it. All right, Cope said finally. This is against my better judgment. But all right. Delighted, Johnson and Toad left at 7 that morning, with Cookie and Little Wind driving the wagon. Cope organized the wooden boxes of fossils, repacking those not sufficiently safe to suffer the depredations of the steamboat's stevedores. Isaac looked after Sternberg, who was delirious most of the time. He boiled him a tea made of the bark of willow branches, which he said helped with fevers. Morton assisted Cope. 6 or 7 other passengers waited at Cow Island for the steamboat. Among them was a Mormon farmer named Travis and his young son. They had come to Montana to bring the gospel to the settlers, but it had little success and were disgruntled. What you got in those crates there? Travis asked. Cope looked up. Fossil bones. What for? I study them, Cope said. Travis laughed. Why study bones when you can study living animals? These are the bones of extinct animals. That can't be. Why not? Cope asked. Are you a God-fearing man? Yes, I am. Do you believe God is perfect? Yes, I do. Travis laughed again. Well then, you must agree there can be no extinct animals, because the good Lord in his perfection would never allow a line of his creatures to become extinct. Why not? Cope asked. I just told you. Travis looked annoyed. You just told me your belief about how God goes about his business. But what if God attains his perfection by degrees, casting aside his past creations in order to create new ones? Men may do that, because men are imperfect. God does not, because he is perfect. There was only one creation. Do you think God made mistakes in his creation? He made man. Didn't you just say man is imperfect? Travis glowered. You're one of those professors, he said. One of those educated fools who has departed from righteousness to blasphemy. Cope was in no mood for theological dispute. "Better an educated fool than an uneducated fool," he snapped. "You are doing the work of the devil," Travis said, and he kicked one of the fossil crates. "Do that again," Cope said, "and I'll beat your brains out." Travis kicked another crate. In a letter to his wife, Cope wrote, "I am dreadfully ashamed of what occurred next, and can offer no excuse save the effort I had expended in collecting these fossils, their priceless value, and my own fatigue after a summer in the heat and bugs and searing alkali of the Badlands. To be confronted by this stupid bigot was too much for me, and my patience abandoned me." Morton described what happened directly. Without preamble or warning, Cope fell upon this man Travis and pounded him into insensibility. It could not have taken more than a minute at most, for Professor Cope was of a pugilistic disposition. Between blows he would say, "How dare you touch my fossils? How dare you?" And at other times he would say scornfully, "In the name of religion." The fight ended when the soldiers pulled Cope off the poor Mormon gentleman, who had said nothing other than what a great many people in the world thought to be utter and indisputable truth. This was certainly still so in 1876. Much earlier in the century, Thomas Jefferson had carefully concealed his own view that fossils represented extinct creatures. In Jefferson's day, public espousal of belief in extinction was considered heresy. Attitudes had since changed in many places, but not everywhere. It was still controversial to espouse evolution in certain parts of the United States. Soon after the fight ended, the steamboat, the Lizzie B, rounded the bend and whistled her imminent arrival. All eyes were on the boat, except for those of one soldier who glanced back across the plains and shouted, "Look there! Horses!" And from across the plains, two riderless horses approached. "My heart sank," Cope wrote in his journal, "to imagine what this might mean." They quickly mounted up and rode out to meet them. As they came closer, they saw Cookie bent over, clutching the saddle near death. A half-dozen Indian arrows pierced his body. Blood streamed freely from his wounds. The other horse belonged to Johnson. There was blood on the saddle, and arrows were stuck in the leather. The army soldiers got Cookie off the horse and laid him on the ground. His lips were swollen and crusted dry. They gave him sips from the canteen until he could speak. "What happened?" Cope said. "Indians," Cookie said. "Damn Indians. Nothing we could..." And he coughed blood, fitfully, writhing with the effort, and died. "We must return at once and search for survivors," Cope said. "And our bones." Captain Lawson shook his head. He yanked one arrow from the saddle. "These are Sioux arrows," he said. "So?" The captain nodded toward the plains. "There won't be anything to go back for, Professor. I'm sorry. But if you find your friends at all, which I doubt, they'll be scalped and mutilated and left to rot on the plains. There must be something we can do. Bury this and say a prayer for the others is about all," Captain Lawson said. The next morning they mournfully loaded their fossils onto the steamboat and headed back down the Missouri. The nearest telegraph station was in Bismarck, Dakota Territory, which was nearly 500 miles to the east on the Missouri. When the Lizzie B stopped there, Cope sent the following cable to Johnson's family in Philadelphia. "I profoundly regret to inform you of the death of your son William and three other men yesterday, August 27th, in the Badlands of the Judith Basin, Montana Territory, at the hands of hostile Sioux Indians. My sincere condolences. Edward Drinker Cope, U.S. Paleontologist." Part 3. Dragon Teeth. On the Plains. From the Journal of William Johnson. Our enthusiasm was absolute as we set out on the morning of August 27th to collect the remainder of the fossils. There were four in our party. Little Wind, the Crow Scout, Toad and myself, riding a little behind, surveying the ground ahead with watchful eyes. And finally Cookie, the teamster, whipping and cursing his animals as he drove the wagon across the prairie. Our journey would take us 12 miles to the Badlands, and 12 miles back again. We rode quickly in order to get there and back to Cow Island by dark. It was a clear, chill, beautiful morning. Feathery cirrus clouds streaked the blue dome of the sky. The Rocky Mountains directly before us gleamed with white snow, which now reached down from the peaks to the deep crevices. The plains grass whispered in a gentle wind. Herds of pale antelope leapt across the distant horizon. Toad and I imagined ourselves as pioneers, leading our little expedition into the wilderness, into excitement and dangers to be met bravely. For two Eastern college students of 18 years, it was hugely exciting. We sat straight in our saddles. We scanned the horizon with narrowed eyes. We kept our hands on our pistol butts and our minds on the business at hand. As the morning continued, we saw a tremendous amount of game, not only antelope, but elk and bison as well. It was far more game than we had seen in our previous weeks on the plain, and we commented on it to each other. We had traveled no more than half the distance to the camp, perhaps 6 miles or so, out into the plains, when Cookie called for a halt. I refused. "No halts until we reach camp," I said.
"You little bastards will halt if I say so," Cookie said.
I turned and saw that Cookie was leveling a shotgun at our midsections. That gave him a deal of authority. We halted.
"What is the meaning of this?" I demanded in a loud voice.
"Shut up, you little blanking-blanking so-and-so," Cookie said, climbing off the wagon. "Now get off your horses, boys."
I looked at Little Wind, but he avoided our eyes.
"Come on, offer your horses," Cookie snarled.
So we dismounted.
"What do you mean by this outrage?" Toad said, blinking his eyes rapidly.
"End of the line, boys," Cookie said, shaking his head. "This is where I get off."
"Where you get off?"
"I can't help it if you're too stupid to see the noses on your faces. You seeing all the game today?"
"What about it?"
"Didn't you ever wonder why you're seeing so much game?"
"It's being driven north, that's why."
"Look there."
He pointed to the south. We looked. Streaky lines of smoke rose into the sky in the distance.
"That's the Sioux camp, you damn fools. That's Sitting Bull."
Cookie was taking our horses, mounting up. I looked again. The fires, if that is what they were very far away.
"But that must be at least a day away from here," I protested. "We can make our camp, load up, and be back to Cow Island before they reach us."
"You boys go right ahead,"
Cookie said. He was mounted on Toad's horse and leading my own. I looked at Little Wind, but he would not meet my eyes. He shook his head.
"Bad day now. Many Sioux warriors in Sitting Bull camp. Kill all crows. Kill all white men."
"You heard the man," Cookie said.
"Me? I value my scalp.
See you, boys.
Come on, Little Wind."
And he started to ride off to the north. A moment later, Little Wind wheeled his horse around and rode off with him. Toad and I stood by the wagon and watched them leave.
"They planned this," Toad said.
He shook his fist at them as they disappeared toward the horizon.
"Bastards! Bastards!"
As for me, my good spirits evaporated. I suddenly realized our predicament. We were two boys alone on the vast and empty plains of the West.
"What do we do now?"
Toad was still angry.
"Cope paid them in advance. Otherwise they would never dare to do this."
"I know," I said, "but what are we going to do now?" Toad squinted at the lines of smoke to the south.
Do you really think those camps are a day away?
How would I know? I cried. I just said that so they wouldn't leave.
Because the thing about Indians is, Toad said, that when they have a large camp like Sitting Bull's, they keep hunting and raiding parties out in front of the main camp.
How far out in front? I asked.
Sometimes 1, 2 days.
We both stared at the fires again.
I make it 6 fires, maybe 7, Toad said. So that can't be the main camp. The main camp would have hundreds of fires.
I made up my own mind. I was not going to return to Cow Island without the fossils. I could not face the professor.
We have to get the fossils, I said.
Right, Toad said. We climbed aboard the wagon and headed west. I had never driven a wagon before, but I made a tolerable job of it. Beside me, Toad whistled nervously.
Let's sing a song, he suggested.
Let's not, I said. And so we drove in silence, with our hearts in our mouths.
They got lost. Their own trail from the day before should have been easy enough to follow, but large stretches of the plains were as flat and featureless as any ocean, and they lost their way several times. They expected to reach the plains camp before noon, but instead finally found the camp in late afternoon. They loaded the wagon with the remaining 10 wooden crates of fossils, which weighed about 1,000 pounds in all, plus some final supplies and Johnson's photographic equipment. He was pleased they had come back, for among the fossils they now packed was, of course, the box with the X, containing the precious Brontosaurus teeth.
Couldn't go home without these, he said. But by the time they were ready to head back, it was after 4 o'clock. And growing dark. They were pretty sure they could never find their way to Cow Island in darkness. That meant they would have to spend the night on the plains. And in another day, the advancing Sioux might come upon them. They were debating just what to do when they heard the savage, blood-curdling cries of Indians.
Oh my God, Toad said.
A dust cloud, stirred up by many riders, appeared on the eastern horizon. It was coming toward them. They scrambled aboard the wagon. Toad broke out the rifles and loaded them.
How much ammunition have we got? Johnson asked.
Not enough, Toad said.
His hands were shaking, dropping shells. The whooping grew louder. They could see a single rider hunched low in the saddle, pursued by a dozen others. But they heard no gunshots.
Maybe they don't have any guns, Toad said hopefully.
At that moment, the first arrow whistled past them.
Let's get out of here.
Which way? Johnson said.
Any way. Away from them.
Johnson whipped up the team and the horses responded with unaccustomed enthusiasm. The wagon rumbled forward at frightening speed, bouncing and tossing over the prairie, the cargo creaking and sliding around in the bed. In the growing darkness, they headed west, away from the Missouri River, away from Cow Island, away from Cope, away from safety. The Indians closed in on them. The solitary rider drew abreast of their wagon, and they saw it was Little Wind. He was soaked in sweat, his horse lathered. Little Wind came very close to the wagon and gracefully leapt aboard. He smacked his pony and set it racing to the north. Several Indians chased it, but the main party continued in pursuit of the wagon.
Damn Sioux! Damn Sioux! Little Wind shouted, grabbing a rifle.
More arrows streaked through the air. Little Wind and Toad fired at the pursuing Indians. Glancing over his shoulder, Johnson estimated there were 12 warriors, perhaps more. The riders came closer and easily surrounded the wagon on 3 sides. Toad and Little Wind fired at them, and both hit one at virtually the same time, blasting him backwards off his horse. Another veered closer until Toad took careful aim and fired. The Sioux warrior clutched his eye, slumped forward, arms limp, then toppled sideways off his horse. One Indian managed to climb aboard the wagon, as Little Wind had done. He was swinging his tomahawk over Johnson when Little Wind shot him in the mouth. In the same instant that the blade cut across Johnson's upper lip, The warrior's face burst red and he fell back off the wagon and was lost in the dust. Johnson grabbed his bleeding face, but there was no time for horror. Little Wind turned to him.
Where you drive? Go south! South is the Badlands!
It was already quite dark. It would be suicide to enter the abrupt cliffs and gullies of the Badlands at night.
Go south! We'll die if we go south. We die anyway. Go south.
And then Johnson realized what he was being told. Their only hope, a slim hope, was to head where the Indians would not follow. He whipped the team, and the wagon plunged southward, toward the Badlands. A mile of open prairie stretched ahead of them, and the Indians again surrounded them on all sides, whooping and shouting. An arrow seared Johnson's leg, pinning his trouser leg to the wooden wagon seat, but he felt no pain and drove on. It was darker and darker. Their guns glowed brightly with each discharge. The Indians, recognizing their plan, pursued them with greater intensity. Soon Johnson could make out the eroded dark line of the Badlands at the edge of the prairie. The flat plains just seemed to drop away into black nothingness. They were approaching at frightful speed.
"Hold on, boys!" he shouted,
and without reining his horses, the wagon plunged over the lip into darkness. Badlands. Silence under a waning moon. Water trickled over his face, onto his lips. He opened his eyes and saw Little Wind leaning close. Johnson raised his head. The wagon sat upright. The horses snorted softly. They were at the base of dark cliffs, looming high. Johnson felt a pinching in his leg. He tried to move.
"Stay," Little Wind said. His voice was tight. "Is something wrong?"
"Stay," he repeated. He put down his canteen and held out another.
"Drink."
Johnson sipped, sputtered, coughed. The whiskey burned his throat, and some splashed on the slash above his lip, making that burn too.
"Drink more," Little Wind said.
He was cutting the cloth of Johnson's trouser leg with a knife. Johnson started to look.
"No look," Little Wind said.
But it was too late. The arrow had pierced the flesh of his right leg, passing under the skin, pinning him to the seat. The flesh around the wound was puffed and purple and ugly. Johnson felt a wave of dizziness and nausea. Little Wind grabbed him.
"Wait. Drink."
Johnson took a big drink. The dizziness returned.
"I fix," Little Wind said, bent over Johnson's leg.
"No look." Johnson stared at the sky, at the moon. Thin clouds drifted past. He felt the whiskey.
"What about Toad?"
"Stay now. No look."
"Is Toad all right?"
"No worry now."
"Where is he?"
"Let me talk to him."
"You feel hurting now,"
Little Wind said, his body tensing. There was a whacking sound, and Johnson felt a pain so sharp he screamed, his voice echoing off the dark cliffs. Immediately he felt a searing, burning pain that was worse. He could not scream. He gasped for breath. Little Wind held the arrow up, bloody in the moonlight.
"Finish now." "I finish."
Johnson started to get up, but Little Wind pushed him back. He gave him the arrow.
"You keep."
Johnson felt warm blood pouring from the open wound. Little Wind bandaged it with a strip of cloth cut from his bandana.
"Good. Good now."
Johnson pushed up, felt pain as he stood, but it was bearable. He was all right.
"Where's Toad?"
Little Wind shook his head. Toad was stretched out in the back of the wagon. One arrow had pierced sideways all the way through his neck. Two others were lodged in his chest. Toad's eyes stared to the left. His mouth gaped open, as if he were still surprised to be dead. Johnson had never seen a dead man before. and felt odd as he closed Toad's eyes and turned away. He was not sad so much as he felt that he was not here in this desolate western place, that he was not alone with some Indian scout, that he was not in mortal danger. His mind simply refused to accept it. He sought something to do and said,
"Well, we better bury him."
"No."
Little Wind seemed horrified.
"Why not?"
"Sue find him."
"Not if we bury him, Little Wind.
Sue find place. They dig him. Take scalp. Take fingers. Women come. Take more."
He pointed to his crotch. Johnson shivered.
"Where are the Sioux now?"
Little Wind pointed to the plains above the cliffs.
"They leave, or they stay?"
"They stay. They come in morning. Maybe bring more warriors."
Weariness overcame Johnson, and his leg throbbed.
"We'll leave as soon as it's light."
"No. Leave now."
Johnson looked up. The clouds were heavier, and there was a faint blue ring circling the moon.
"It'll be pitch dark in a few minutes. There won't even be starlight."
"Must leave," insisted Little Wind.
"It's a miracle we've survived this far, but we can't go on through the Badlands in darkness."
"Leave now," Little Wind said.
"But we'll die. We die anyway. Leave now."
They moved through utter blackness. Johnson drove the wagon, with Little Wind walking a few paces ahead. Little Wind carried a long stick and a handful of rocks. When he could not see the terrain ahead, he threw rocks. Sometimes it took a long time for the rocks to land, and when the sound came back, it was distant and hollow and echoing. Then Little Wind would edge forward, tapping the ground with the stick like a blind man until he found the edge of the precipice. He would then point the wagon in a different direction. Their progress was exhausting and painfully slow. Johnson could not believe they were making more than a few hundred yards in an hour's time. It seemed pointless. At dawn, the Indians would charge down the ravines, pick up their trail, and find them in a matter of minutes.
"What is the point?" he would demand when the throbbing in his leg became especially bad.
"Look at sky," Little Wind would say.
"I see the sky. It's black. The sky is black."
Little Wind said nothing.
"What about the damned sky?" he demanded.
But Little Wind explained no further. Shortly before dawn, it began to snow. They had reached Bear Creek at the edge of the Badlands, and they paused to water the team.
"Snow good," Little Wind said. "Unkpapa warriors see snow. Know they follow us easy. They wait. Stay warm by fire 1-2 hours in morning.
And meanwhile, we go like hell."
Little Wind nodded.
"Go like hell."
From Bear Creek they headed west across open prairie, as fast as they could with the horses. The wagon jolted over the prairie. The pain in his leg was severe.
"Where are we going? Fort Benton?"
Little Wind shook his head.
"All white men go to Fort Benton."
"You mean the Sioux expect us to go there?"
He nodded.
"Then where are we going?"
"Sacred Mountains."
"What Sacred Mountains?" Johnson asked, alarmed.
"Thunder Mountains of Great Spirit."
"Why are we going there?"
Little Wind did not answer.
"How far away are these Sacred Mountains? What will we do when we get there?"
4 days. "You wait," Little Wind said. "You find many white men."
"But why are you going there?"
Johnson noticed now that Little Wind's buckskin shirt was seeping red, staining with blood.
"Little Wind, are you hurt?"
In a high falsetto voice, Little Wind began to chant a song. He did not speak again. They turned south, across the plains. Little Wind died silently on the third night. Johnson awoke at dawn to find him lying stiffly by the smoldering campfire, his face covered with snow, his skin cold to the touch. Using his rifle for support, Johnson dragged Little Wind's body to the wagon, painfully hoisted it up into the bed next to Toad's, and drove on. He was feverish, hungry, and often delirious. He was sure he was lost, but he did not care. He began to remind himself to keep sitting up, even as his mind separated itself from his ordeal, creating distracting and confusing visions. At one point he believed that the wagon was approaching Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia, and that he was searching unsuccessfully for his family's mansion. Early in the fourth day, he found a clear wagon track, freshly used. The track wound eastward, toward a range of low purple hills. He went into the hills. As he continued on, he found places where timber had been cut and initials had been carved in trees, evidence of white men. It was very cold, and the snow was falling heavily when he climbed a final ridge and saw a town in the gully below, a single muddy street of square utilitarian wooden buildings. He whipped up the horses and rode down to it. And that was how, on August 31st, 1876, William Johnson, nearly fainting from hunger, thirst, exhaustion, and blood loss, rode with a wagon load of bones and the dead bodies of a white man and a Snake Scout into the town of Deadwood Gulch. Deadwood. Deadwood presented a bleak aspect, a single street of unpainted wooden buildings surrounded by bare hills. The trees had been cut down to provide lumber for the town. Everything was covered in a thin crust of dirty snow. But despite the dreary appearance, the town had the charged excitement of a boom town. The main street of Deadwood consisted of the usual mining town variety. A tin shop, a carpenter shop, three dry goods stores, four stables, six grocery stores, a Chinatown with four Chinese laundries, and 75 saloons. And in the center of it all, boasting a wooden second-story balcony, stood the Grand Central Hotel. Johnson staggered up the front steps, and the next thing he knew he was lying on a padded bench inside the hotel, attended to by the proprietor, an older man with thick glasses and thinning greased hair. "Young fellow," he joked, "I've seen men in worse shape, but a percentage of them was dead."
"Food?" Johnson croaked.
"We got plenty of food here. I'm going to help you into the dining room and we'll get some victuals into you."
"You got any money?"
An hour later, he was feeling distinctly better and looked up from his plate.
"That was good."
"What was it?" The woman clearing the table said, "That's buffalo tongue." The proprietor, who was named Sam Perkins, looked in. Considering the rough surroundings, he was extremely polite.
"I'm thinking you need a room, young man."
Johnson nodded. $4, payable in advance. And a bath can be obtained down the street at the Deadwood Public Baths."
"Much obliged," Johnson said.
"That pretty slash on your face is going to heal by itself. Leave a scar. But that leg needs attention."
"I am in agreement," said Johnson wearily.
Perkins asked where Johnson had come from. He said he had come from the Badlands of Montana near Fort Benton. Perkins looked at him in disbelief, but said only that it was a long way to come. Johnson stood up and asked if there was some place he could store the crates on his wagon. Perkins said he had a room in the back, available to hotel guests, and that only he had the key to the lock on its door.
"What do you have to store?"
"Bones," Johnson said, realizing the warm food had given him some strength.
"You mean animal bones?"
"That's right."
"You making soup?"
Johnson didn't appreciate the joke.
"These are valuable to me."
Perkins said he didn't think that anyone in Deadwood would be interested in stealing his bones.
Johnson said he had gone through hell and back for these bones, and he had two dead bodies in his wagon to prove it, and he wasn't taking any chances. Could he please store his bones in the storeroom? How much space you need? It ain't a barn. I got 10 wood boxes of bones, and then some other supplies. Well, let's see them. Perkins followed Johnson back out onto the street, looked in the wagon, and nodded. While Johnson started moving crates, Perkins inspected the snow-covered bodies. He brushed the snow away. This one's an Indian. That's right. Perkins squinted at Johnson. How long you had these two with you? One's been dead almost a week. The Indian died yesterday. Perkins scratched his chin. He asked, You thinking of burying your friend? Now I've got him away from the Sioux. I guess I will. There's a graveyard at the north end of town. What about the Indian? I'll bury him too. Not in the graveyard. He's a snake. Good for him, Perkins said. We don't have no problem with snakes that is alive. But you can't bury any Indian in the graveyard. Why not? Town won't stand for it. Johnson glanced at the unpainted wood buildings. The town didn't seem to have been there long enough to have formed a civic opinion on any subject. But he simply asked why not. He's a heathen. He's a snake. And I didn't bury him for the same reason I didn't bury the white man. If the Sioux found the grave, they'd dig him up and mutilate him. This Indian led me to safety. I owe him a decent burial. That's fine. You do what you want with him, Perkins said, long as you don't bury him in the graveyard. You don't want to cause trouble. Not in Deadwood. Johnson was too tired to argue. He carried the crates of fossils inside, stacking them to take up as little space as possible, and made sure Perkins locked the room after he exited. Then he asked the proprietor to arrange for his bath, and went off to bury the bodies. It took a long time to dig the hole for Toad in the graveyard at the end of town. He had to use a pick before shoveling out the rocky earth. He dragged Toad out of the wagon and into the grave, which didn't look comfortable. Even for a dead man. I'm sorry, Toad, he said aloud. I'll tell your family when I get the chance. When the first shovel of earth landed on Toad's face, Johnson stopped. I'm not who I used to be, he thought. Then he finished filling in the grave. He took Little Wind's body outside the town, along a side road, and dug a grave beneath a spreading fir tree on the slope of a hill. The ground was easier to dig in this location, which made him think the town should have located the graveyard there instead. The hill faced north, and from the site you could not see any sign of habitation or white men. Then he sat down and cried until he was too cold to stay out anymore. He returned to town, had his bath, carefully cleaning and bandaging his wounded leg. Then he pulled on his dirty, blood-crusted clothes again. For he had no others. In his hotel room, there was a small mirror above the wash basin, and he inspected the slash above his lip for the first time. The edges of the wound had started to heal, but hadn't closed up. There would be quite a scar. The bed was a thin straw mattress over a simple lumber frame. He slept for 30 hours, straight through. From Johnson's journal. When I went down to eat in the hotel dining room 2 days later, I discovered that I had become the most famous person in Deadwood. Over antelope steaks, the 5 other hotel guests, all rough miners, plied me with bourbon and questions about my recent activities. Like the proprietor, Mr. Perkins, they were exceedingly polite in their manner, and everyone kept their hands on the table when they ate. But I noticed, polite or not, that they did not believe my story. It took some time to learn why. Apparently anyone who claimed to have crossed from Montana into Dakota was on the face of it a liar, since anyone who tried it would be certain to die at the hands of the Sioux.
But the fact was I had encountered no Indians at all since the attack on the wagon. Sitting Bull's Sioux must have been to the north of us when we had made our crossing. But in Deadwood, the story was not believed, and this drew attention on my bones, which I had stored. One interested guest was a hard customer called Broken Nose Jack McCall, whose moniker was likely the result of a barroom altercation. Broken Nose also had one eye that looked steadfastly to the left, with a pale blue cast to it, like a bird of prey. Whether because of his eye or some other reason, he was very mean, but not so mean as his companion, Black Dick Curry, who had a snake tattoo on his left wrist and the unlikely nickname, the Miner's Friend. When I asked Perkins why he was called the Miner's Friend, the proprietor said it was a kind of joke. "What do you mean, a joke?" I asked. "We can't get proof of it, but most folks reckon Dick Curry and his brothers, Clem and Bill, are the highwaymen who rob the stagecoaches and gold shipments going from Deadwood down to Laramie and Cheyenne," Perkins explained. "We're near Cheyenne?" Johnson asked, suddenly excited. For the 100th time, he cursed his lack of geographical knowledge. "Near to there as anywhere," the proprietor said. "I want to go there," Johnson said. "Nobody keeping you here, is there?" In high excitement, thinking of Lucienne, he returned to his room to pack. But after he unlocked the door, he discovered the room had been searched, and his personal articles scattered around. His wallet was missing. All his money was gone. He went downstairs to Perkins at the desk. "I've been robbed." "How can that be?" Perkins said, and accompanied him upstairs. Perkins viewed the room with equanimity. "Just one of the boys, burdened with curiosity, checking out your story. They didn't take anything, did they?"
"Yes, they took my wallet."
"How can that be?" Perkins said.
"It was here in my room."
"You left your wallet in your room?"
"I was only going downstairs to dinner."
"Mr. Johnson," Perkins said gravely, "you're in Deadwood. You can't leave your money unattended for a breath."
"Well, I did."
"That is a problem," Perkins said.
"You better call the town marshal and report the robbery."
"Mr. Johnson, there's no marshal in Deadwood."
"No marshal?"
"Mr. Johnson, there was no town here this time last year. We surely haven't gotten around to hiring a marshal. Besides, I don't think the boys would stand for one. They'd kill him first thing. Just 2 weeks back, Bill Hickok was killed here."
"Wild Bill Hickok?"
"That's him." Perkins explained that Hickok was playing cards in Nuttall and Mann's saloon when Jack McCall came in and shot him through the back of the head. The bullet passed through Hickok's head and lodged in the wrist of another player. Hickok was dead before his hands touched his guns.
"The Jack McCall I had dinner with?"
"That's him. Most folks figure Jack was hired to shoot Wild Bill by folks who were afraid he'd be hired as town marshal. Now I reckon nobody's eager for the job."
"Then who keeps the law here?"
"There is no law here," Perkins said. "This is Deadwood." He was speaking slowly, as if to a stupid child. "Judge Harlan presides over the inquests, when he's sober enough. But other than that, there's no law at all. And people like it that way. Hell, every saloon in Deadwood is technically against the law. This is Indian territory, and you can't sell spirits in Indian territory."
"All right," Johnson said. "Where is the telegraph office?
I'll wire my father for funds. Pay you and be gone." Perkins shook his head.
"No telegraph office?"
"Not in Deadwood, Mr. Johnson. Not yet, anyway." "What do I do about my stolen money?" "That is a problem," Perkins agreed. "You've been here 3 days now. You owe $6 plus your dinner tonight, that's a dollar more. And you stabled your horses with Colonel Ramsey?"
"Yes, down the street."
Well, he's going to want $2 a day, so that makes $6 or $8 more you owe him. I reckon you can sell him your wagon and team to square it.
If I sell my wagon and team, how can I leave with my bones?
That is a problem, Perkins said. It surely is.
I know it is a problem,
Johnson began to shout. Now, Mr. Johnson, keep a cool head, Perkins said soothingly. You still intending to go to Laramie and Cheyenne?
That's right.
Then that wagon is no good to you anyhow.
Why not?
Mr. Johnson, why don't you come downstairs and allow me to pour you a drink? I suspect there's one or two facts that ought to make your acquaintance.
The facts were these. There were two roads to Deadwood, north and south. Johnson had driven into Deadwood unmolested only because he had arrived from the north. Nobody was ever expected from the north. The route was bad, and there were hostile Indians in the north, and consequently the road was unattended by brigands and highwaymen. On the other hand, the road to Laramie and Cheyenne ran south, and that road was thick with thieves. They sometimes preyed on emigrants coming up to seek their fortune. But they especially preyed on anything moving south out of Deadwood. In addition, there were marauding bands of Indians, assisted by white bandits such as the notorious Persimmons Bill, who was said to have led the savages responsible for the massacre of the entire Metz party in Red Canyon earlier that year. The stagecoach line had started up that spring with a single armed guard or messenger, riding shotgun up with the driver. Pretty soon they laid on two messengers, then three. Lately there were never less than four, and when the gold stage went south once a week, it traveled in a convoy with a dozen heavily armed guards. Even then, they didn't always make it through. Sometimes they were driven back to Deadwood, and sometimes they were killed and the gold stolen.
You mean the guards were killed?
Guards and passengers both, Perkins said. These highwaymen just naturally kill anyone they come across. It's their way of doing business.
That's appalling.
Yep. It's bad, too.
How am I going to leave?
Well, this is what I've been trying to explain, Perkins said patiently. It's a good deal easier to come to Deadwood than to leave.
What can I do?
Well, come spring, things should cool down a bit. They say Wells Fargo will start a coach line, and they have experience cleaning up desperados. You'll be safe then.
In the spring?
But this is September. I believe so, Perkins said.
You're trying to tell me I'm stuck here in Deadwood until spring?
I believe so, Perkins said, pouring him another drink.
Life in Deadwood. There was a good deal of gunfire during the late hours, and Johnson spent a restless night. He awoke with an aching head. Perkins gave him strong black coffee, and he went out to see what he could do to raise funds. The snow had melted during the night. The street was now ankle deep with stinking mud, the wooden buildings streaked with damp. Deadwood looked especially dreary, and the prospect of remaining there for 6 or 7 months depressed him. Nor were his spirits improved when he saw a dead man lying on his back in the muddy street. Flies buzzed around the body. 3 or 4 loungers stood over it, smoking cigars and discussing its former owner, but no one made any attempt to move the corpse, and the passing teams of horses just wheeled past it.
Johnson stopped. What happened?
That's Willie Jackson. He was in a fracas last night.
A fracas?
I believe he engaged in disputing with Black Dick Curry, and they settled it outside in the street.
Another man said, Willie always did drink overmuch.
You mean Dick shot him?
Ain't the first time. Dick likes to kill. does it when he can.
You just going to leave him there?
I don't know who'll move him, one said. Well, he's got no relatives to fret over him. He had a brother, but he died of dysentery about 2 months back. They had a small claim a couple of miles east of here.
Whatever happened to that claim? One man asked, flicking his cigar.
I don't believe it amounted to nothing.
Never did have luck.
No, Willie never did.
Johnson said, so the body will just stay here? One man jerked a thumb to the store behind them. The sign read, Kim Sing Washing and Ironing.
Well, he's in front of Sing's place. I reckon Sing will move him before he gets too ripe and ruins business.
Sing's sons will move him.
Too heavy for the son, I imagine. He's only about 11.
No, that little one is strong.
Not that strong. He moved old Jake when the carriage ran him down.
That's so. He did move Jake.
They were still discussing it when Johnson walked on. At Colonel Ramsey's stables, he offered his wagon and team for sale. Cope had purchased them in Fort Benton for the inflated price of $180. Johnson thought he could get $40 or perhaps $50. Colonel Ramsey offered $10. After a long complaint, Johnson agreed to it. Ramsey then explained Johnson owed $6 already and plunked down the difference, $4 silver dollars on the countertop.
This is an outrage, Johnson said.
Silently, Ramsey picked one of the $4 off the counter.
What's that for?
That's for insulting me, Ramsey said. Care to do it again?
Colonel Ramsey was a hard-bitten man well over 6 feet tall. He wore a long-barreled Colt six-shooter on each hip. Johnson took the remaining $3 and turned to leave.
You got a mouth, you little bastard, Ramsey said. I was you. I'd learn to keep it shut.
I appreciate the advice,
Johnson said quietly. He was beginning to understand why everyone in Deadwood was so polite, so almost preternaturally calm. He next went to the Black Hills Overland and Mail Express at the north end of the street. The agent there informed him that the fare to Cheyenne was $8 by regular coach and $30 by the express coach.
Why does the express cost so much more?
Your express coach is pulled by a team of 6. Standard coach is pulled by a team of 2, and it's slower.
That's the only difference?
Well, of late the slow coach hasn't been making it through regular.
Oh.
Johnson then explained that he had some freight to transport as well. The agent nodded.
Most folks do. If it's gold, it's 1.5% of appraised value.
It's not gold.
Well, then, it goes at freight rate, 5 cents a pound.
How much you got?
About 1,000 pounds.
1,000 pounds? What on earth you got weighs 1,000 pounds?
Bones, Johnson said.
That's highly unusual, the agent said.
I don't know as we could accommodate you.
He scratched figures on a sheet of paper.
These, bones can ride up top?
I guess they can, if they're safe up there.
At 5 cents per pound, Johnson figured, the cost would be $50.
Be $80, plus $5 loading fee.
More than he expected.
Oh, 50 for the freight and 30 for the express. 85 in all.
The clerk nodded.
You want a book passage?
Not right now.
You know where to find us if you do, he said, and turned away.
As Johnson was leaving, he paused at the door.
About the express coach, he said.
Yes?
How often does it get through?
Well, it gets through mostly, the agent said.
It's your best bet, no question of that.
But how often?
The agent shrugged.
I'd say 3 out of 5 get through. A few of them get ventilated on the way, but mostly they're fine.
Thank you, Johnson said.
Don't mention it, the agent said.
You sure you don't got gold nuggets in them boxes?
The agent wasn't the only one who had heard about the boxes of bones.
all of Deadwood had, and there was plenty of speculation. It was known, for example, that Johnson had arrived in Deadwood with a dead Indian. Since Indians knew better than any white man where the gold was in their sacred Black Hills, many people figured the Indian had shown Johnson the gold, and then Johnson had killed him and his own partner and made off with the ore, now disguised as crates of bones. Others were equally sure the crates didn't contain gold, since Johnson hadn't taken it across the street to the assayer, which was the only sensible thing to do with gold. But the crates might still be plenty valuable, containing jewels or even cash money. But in that case, why didn't he take them to the Deadwood Bank? Here the only possible explanation was that the crates contained some recognizable stolen treasure that would be identified at once by the bankers. What that treasure might be was hard to say, but everybody talked about it a great deal.
"I think you might want to move those bones," said Sam Perkins. "People are talking. I can't guarantee they won't get stolen from the storeroom."
"Can I carry them up to my own room?"
"Nobody will help you if that's what you're asking."
"I wasn't asking that."
"Suit yourself. You want to sleep in the same room with a lot of animal bones, nobody will say nothing."
So that is what he did. 10 boxes up the stairs, stacked carefully against the wall, more or less blocking all the light from his one window.
"Course everybody knows you moved them upstairs," said Perkins, tagging along. "That makes them look even more valuable."
"I thought of that."
"The posts in that wall are good, but anybody could bust open that door."
"I could build a thick timber slide lock on the inside, same as a stable door."
Perkins nodded. "That keeps those boxes safe when you are in the room. But what about when you ain't?"
"Cut 2 holes around the post, one in the wall and one in the door. Use a chain with a padlock."
"You got a good padlock?"
"Nope."
"I do. But you got to buy it from me. $10. Came off a Sioux City and Pacific boxcar door that caught fire. Heavier than it looks."
"I would be much obliged."
"You would be further obliged, financially speaking."
"Yes."
"So I expect you'll have to get a job," Perkins said. "You need to raise over $100, plus what you owe me. That's a good deal of money to come by, honestly."
Johnson didn't need to be told that.
"Any work you can do? Useful work?"
"I dug all summer."
"Everybody here can dig. That's the only reason folks come to the Black Hills, to mine. No, I mean, can you cook or shoe horses or do carpentry? Anything like that. A skill."
"No, I'm a student." Johnson looked at the crates of fossils. He rested his hand on one, touched it. He could leave the fossils here. He could take the stage from Deadwood to Fort Laramie, and from there cable home for money. He could tell Cope, assuming Cope was still alive, that the fossils had been lost. A story formed in his mind. They had been ambushed. The wagon had overturned, fallen over a cliff. All the fossils were lost or smashed. It was a pity, but it couldn't be helped. Anyway, he thought, these fossils weren't so important, for the entire American West was full of fossils. Wherever you dug into a cliff, you found old bones of one sort or another. There were certainly far more fossils than gold in this wilderness. These few wouldn't be missed. At the rate Cope and Marsh were collecting bones, in a year or two these would hardly even be remembered. Another idea came to him. Leave the fossils here in Deadwood, go to Laramie, wire for money, and with proper funds return to Deadwood, collect the fossils, and leave again. But he knew that if he ever got out of Deadwood alive, he'd never come back. Not for anything. He must either take them now, or turn tail and run without them. "Dragon Teeth," he said softly, touching the crate, remembering the moment of their discovery.
"What's that?" said Perkins.
"Nothing," Johnson said. Try as he might,
He could not diminish the importance of the fossils in his mind. It was not merely that he had dug them with his own hands, his own sweat. It was not merely that men had died, that his friends and companions had died in the course of finding them. It was because of what Cope had said.